Hello, thank you very much indeed. I'm going to be speaking, I think, in a way that is very much consonant with a point that Mary Beth made in the first presentation, and that is to say, it is useful to look, I believe, at end-of-life care, hospice and palliative care from a public health point of view. And when you do that, you may see some things that jump out at you differently than if you look at it, say, from a kind of clinical medical and nursing point of view. I think that one of the aspects of looking at public health, looking at hospice and palliative care from a public health point of view, is of course to see the epidemiology of pain and suffering and of inadequate relief of those conditions and inadequate access to services and things of that kind. But another aspect, I think, of the public health point of view is to look at healthcare and the meeting of the social provision of meeting health and medical needs as a kind of a system problem, a kind of systems design issue. And that's what occurred to me, and I'm going to base this presentation on an account of two different system design approaches that we have taken in the United States since the late 1960s and early 1970s to end-of-life care, to improving the quality and the adequate addressing of human needs in our end-of-life care policies and practices, laws, and financial systems. And I think that by looking at those two different design principles and those two different design structures, we can then begin to think about the future in terms of how do we and how might we better redesign our end-of-life care system. And that, to me, means something very significant for the palliative and hospice care portion of end-of-life care. And I think that, so that's what I want to focus on. The first and the last bullet point, really, is all that I'm going to have time for in this presentation. I'll have to give rather short shrift to the others, which describe some of the problems that we've encountered over the last 30-plus years with both the initial end-of-life care, a design system that I'll refer to as a patient empowerment design, and the initial hospice care design system, which has had its problems also. Why do we need to worry about the system design of end-of-life care at all? Well, basically, it's the old story. We're very familiar with this phenomenon. It has not, in fact, changed fundamentally, it seems to me. Our technology's gotten much better. We're much better at rescuing people from fatal illness. We have a lot more people that we're rescuing, but nonetheless, there is a persistent gap between our power to extend life and our power to extend and enhance quality of life. And as long as that gap exists, as long as we have halfway and life-sustaining medical technologies, we will have the issue of how do we design and how do we control end-of-life care in our society in a proper way. Technology has made the timing of one's death more of an explicit choice than it was earlier, and the technology, I would argue, has also led to severe problems with continuity of care and advanced end-of-life care planning, which we don't do well in our healthcare system today. Here's an example of the technology coming in between the patient and a sort of continuity of care ideal. You have subspecialization, and Zelig here is being ministered to by a number of specialists, but it's not clear where Zelig's doctor actually is in this picture. Again, I'll just quickly show this slide. From the late 1960s, we have medical technologies developing rapidly, and we have a whole series of things happening to design our end-of-life care system in the United States right up to the present day. beginning with the notion of declaration of death by whole brain criteria, and then moving through the notion of advanced directives. Very important Supreme Court cases in many states, appellate court cases finally culminating in the first United States Supreme Court case, in the Cruzan case in 1990, basically affirming that our end-of-life care system must adhere to the notion that individuals have a right to refuse to consent to and refuse medical treatment, all forms of medical treatment, including life-sustaining medical treatment, and all modalities of life-sustaining medical treatment, including artificial nutrition and hydration. So that was clearly developed in the state courts and then reaffirmed by the this U.S. Supreme Court as a matter of constitutional right up through the 70s into the early 90s. The decade of the 90s also saw that notion of individual rights extended beyond refusal of life-sustaining medical technologies and into the area of physician aid in dying. And Mary Beth mentioned a number of those state laws are now passed, and the movement for that continues. But basically, the end-of-life care system has been designed and predicated on rather explicit ethical and value considerations, and that's one of the things that makes it interesting as a kind of healthcare design system issue. Because a lot of times healthcare systems in other areas are not so explicitly designed and argued about in ethical terms. But end-of-life care has been, perhaps it's a little bit of a historical and cultural anomaly that it has been, for good or ill, it has been a place where people in my profession, bioethics, have been kept busy, and actually I think made something of a contribution to the design elements and the passage of various laws. I would hazard a guess, by the way, that part of the reason it's been so explicitly centered around ethical and value principles and concepts is that so much of the reform and so much of the design change has been driven and motivated by court cases, followed by a state statutory legislative activity, followed by regulatory and fiscal activity. But when you argue over something, first and foremost as a fundamental constitutional right and human right, the discourse surrounding that social problem is bound to be explicitly ethical and value in nature. The two design strategies that I discern are interestingly coincident in terms of their historical origins. The first United States hospice opened in 1973, the Quinlan case of 1975, 1976 in New Jersey. Both of these were grassroots movements growing out of patient and family dissatisfaction with mainstream healthcare, end-of-life care at that time. The two strategies I call the individualistic empowerment approach and the relational systems approach, the first being the Quinlan approach, the second being the hospice approach, essentially. We improve end-of-life care by empowering individual patients to control and direct their own care. And as a corollary to that, if a patient has lost, due to the progression of illness and other circumstances, decision-making capacity, then someone else, that person doesn't lose their right to direct and control their own health care. Rather, some other person has to exercise that right on their behalf. And how you do that is the advanced care directive and the rules for surrogate decision-making, which were already there, of course, in the Karen Ann Quinlan case, since Karen Ann was had severe anoxic brain injury, was in a permanent vegetative unconscious state, and it was always her father, her family, who were speaking on her behalf and requesting that the ventilator be disconnected. So from the very beginning, most of these cases and most of the discussion has been about the ethical and regulatory and legal problems surrounding surrogate decision-making, rather than the competent adult patient speaking who's dying speaking for himself or herself about what kind of machinery and life supports they do or do not want. That's kind of the easier case, if any of this is easy, than the indirect advance directive kind of a case. And then what do you do about people who don't have advance directives? Who gets to decide in their case? Here is a representation, which you obviously can't read, it's way too small, of the sort of decision tree that grows out of the individual empowerment design strategy. And I put it up there simply to indicate to you the complexity of it. This is basically about, does the patient have capacity, yes or no? If the patient doesn't have capacity, does he have an advance directive, yes or no? And if there's no advance directive, then who has to decide on what basis? And that's the sort of going down the center of that thing, which is the longest pathway of all. I point this out to you because this is a very complicated system design. And it is very demanding and burdensome for individual patients near the end of their lives who have capacity, and extremely burdensome for others whom they have named or who come forward, family members often as natural surrogates. Very, very burdensome and difficult decision-making responsibilities are placed on the shoulders of people who are not well equipped often and not well counseled or supported by the healthcare professionals very often to make extremely difficult decisions. And that's the basic Achilles heel of the individual empowerment strategy, even though ethically and politically it sounds really very good, because it was attacking a kind of paternalism, mostly by physicians, in terms of, I know best what's best for you, just follow orders, and I'll hook you up to this ventilator and everything will be fine, until it's not. Or I'll give you the chemotherapy until it doesn't work anymore, and then everything will be fine until I say goodbye to you, and then where do you go? And it was that latter kind of healthcare system, a paternalistic and passive system, that prompted both, in a way, the individual empowerment strategy and the relational system strategy. The hospice movement was a response to, in effect, that question of where do you go when high-tech medical acute life-sustaining care doesn't work for you anymore? And what kind of empowerment, what kind of recognition, what kind of support can you get, what kind of relief of your symptoms and pain and suffering should you get? And really, before the development of hospice programs, there really was very little, but family support and home care, there was very little that the official healthcare system offered for people at that very late stage in the progression of their illness and their life. Things are changing. One of the important things that's happening, I think, is that we are moving away from the idea of simply advance directives as living wills or pieces of paper, and we're moving more into the notion of having some kind of system of advanced care planning where the goals of care and case management and care planning really are done in a more systematic way. Continuity of care is more attended to than it has been in the past. And in the hospice realm, I think what we're seeing, partly because of the development of kind of a parallel palliative care movement over the years, is that hospice programs are asking themselves whether or not the restrictive nature of the hospice of the Medicare hospice benefit, which is to say that you have to be expected to live for 6 months or less if your disease follows its normal course, and you really have to kind of forego any other sort of medical disease-modifying medical treatment. If you're going to have the palliative care benefit of hospice, those kinds of restrictions are, in fact, overly restrictive and not well suited to a relational design system of the kind that we should, in fact, be developing. And so hospice has been wrestling with being a kind of niche provider, and it's been wrestling with its public image, it's been wrestling with getting referral patterns going, it's been wrestling with the financial straits of dealing with palliative care more broadly. Here's my David Letterman top 10 list of why end-of-life care has been so difficult to reform. I have to skip over it quickly. I must say that if I were doing this list again, this isn't meant to be the rank order priority, but I do think I'd probably put mistrust, which is now number 10, way up higher in the list. I think that that's a root cause of a lot of some of the problems we're having. I think we would all agree on this one with Chief Dan George. It's never a good day to die. But nevertheless, it may be a pretty good day to plan for that inevitable day when it does come, so forth and so on. Culture wars and mistrust. There's still a great deal of misunderstanding about the motivation behind and the effects of improving access to palliative care and hospice care. And now we're entering a phase of more and more explicit economic and commercialization of healthcare generally. It's more and more on people's minds. And I do worry that people are going to be looking at the bottom question there and really wondering if being encouraged to move into palliative care systems and hospice systems, which are clearly cost-effective compared to dying in the hospital, whether or not there's going to be some sort of ulterior motive of rationing in a sort of a malevolent and unjust sense, driving this message of an encouragement to move where people really should, in fact, most of them, move for the sake of their own dignity and their rights and their well-being. But we're going to muddy the waters terribly, I'm afraid. Of course, that's what we do here in America, right? Where do we go from here? Well, I think we need to go from this, that our old friend, the individual empowerment chart, to this, which is a notion of an expanded kind of conception of hospice and palliative care, where hospice is not the very last 6 months of life that you kind of totally different from the rest of the system, but you have a more continuum of care notion in which two types of approach to end-of-life care, disease-modifying care and consequence-modifying care, in Frank Ferris's terminology, they blend and move together depending on the patient's progressive chronic illness and the patient's needs, so that you get from the very early stage, from the point of diagnosis, maybe 2 years out, maybe 3 years out, you get a kind of coordinated care plan that has elements of both disease-modifying and consequence-modifying care, and you titrate it according to the progress and the needs of individual patients and families. You keep a lot of the hospice philosophy, you keep the holism, you keep the relationality, and you dispense with a lot of the philosophy behind the individual empowerment approach, which is essentially a kind of individualistic autonomy and negative liberty. Leave me alone. I don't want that ventilator. I don't want this. I don't want that. Get out of my face, which is really not the value base that works in the end of a person's lives or the end of life for families. You have to really see the individual as not having to fight like hell to keep from getting something they don't want and fight like hell to get something they do want. What you need is a system that will make it very easy for people to get what they do want, mostly, and is good for them, mostly. They shouldn't have to jump through all these hoops. If they want to fight, then they can get out of that sort of default system, and they can get into the ICU or wherever, you know, the experimental chemotherapy trial or wherever they do want to be. So we should allow people to go where their rights, you know, and values and preferences will lead them, for sure. By advance directive or directly by their own voice. But we shouldn't make the systemic default maximal life-sustaining treatment the way we do today. So we have to reconstrue rights and we have to work through relationships. We have to move from, I think, a kind of an individualistic and negative view of autonomy to a much more relational understanding of autonomy. We need to stress communications and collaborative planning between healthcare professionals, families, patients, and agents and surrogates who are named by the patient. We have to have a much better communicative, relational system of care. And to me, that is a sort of reinvented, reconstructed form of hospice care with following Ferris's chart and moving upstream to really become not just a system of end-of-life care, but increasingly a system for managing chronic illness, leading up to the end-of-life period, a terminal period of a disease. So thanks very much. I look forward to conversation if we have any time left. Thank you.